These people intend to have their friends using the front door.
What would you have to do? Use your girlfriend?
I will not have a lot of mildewed pus bags running in and out of the door. Still here.
Good morning, John.
Go away. The Stallions have been arrested for bootlegging.
Good morning, Mr. Whiteside. I'm Jefferson of the Marseille Journal.
Get rid of him.
I'm sorry. Mr. Whiteside is seeing no one.
Oh, really?
So if you'll please excuse us. Good day.
Mr. Whiteside seems to be sitting up and taking notice.
I'm afraid he's not taking notice of the Marseille Journal. Do you mind?
You know, if I'm going to be insulted, I'd like to be by Mr. Whiteside himself. I never did like carbon copies.
Touché, if I ever heard one. And Marseille too, Maggie dear.
Would you please leave?
How about an interview, Mr. Whiteside?
I never give them. Go away.
Oh, Mr. Whiteside, if I don't get this interview, I'd lose my job.
That would be perfectly all right with me.
Now, you don't mean that, Mr. Whiteside. You used to be a newspaper man yourself. You know what that is like. Well, mine's the toughest one that ever lived.
You won't get around me that way. If you don't like him, get off the paper.
Yes, but I think it's a good paper. You see, the Journal was my father's paper. You might say it's a sentimental point, and I like to carry on where he left off.
I see. So you own the paper, eh?
That's right.
And this terrifying editor, this dread journalistic apocalypse, is you yourself?
In a word, yes. I think this town needs intellectual stimulation, despite the opposition of such mental retards as your host, Mr. Stanley. He's the local kingpin, since he owns the major factory in this town.
If Ernest W. Stanley is any indication of the intellectual level of Massalia, Ohio, this town does not need stimulation. It needs an embalmer.
In the future, Sherry, just let me know when you don't want to talk to me. I'll usher the right in.
Young man, I suppose you've written that great American novel.
Oh, I've written that great American play.
Well, I don't want to read it. Do these old eyes see a box of goodies over there? Hand them to me, will you, Jefferson?
Trouble is, Mr. Whiteside, that you being in this town comes under the heading of news. Practically the biggest news since the Depression. So I just gotta get the story.
Pecan butternut fudge.
Now, Mr. Whiteside, you shouldn't eat candy. It's very bad for you.
But my great-aunt Jennifer ate a whole box of candy every day of her life. And she lived to be 102. And when she had been dead 3 days, she looked better than you do now. You were saying, old fellow.
Well, I can at least report to my readers the chivalry is not yet dead.
We won't discuss it. Well, now that you've won me with your pretty ways, I'll grant you a 1-minute interview.
Well, how about a brief talk of famous murder? You know, authority on murder is a fine art.
When I speak of murder, I get paid for it. I made more money out of the mad bomber case than the lawyers did, so don't expect to get it for nothing.
Okay, then. How do you think Ohio women stack up?
I don't go in much for stacking up women, so I really couldn't say.
Then what do you think of Marseille? How long are you going to be here? Where are you going? Things like that.
Very well. Hey, Marseille is a town of irresistible charm. B, I can't wait to get out of it. And C, I go from here to Crockfield Home for my semi-annual visit to my home for paroled convicts, for which I have raised over $5 million in the past few years.
Filched from the pockets of an all too gullible and long-suffering woman.
Ignore her, Jefferson. She's been demented ever since she threw herself under Rudolph Valentino's hearse.
I see.
Tell me, Jefferson, have you ever been to Crockfield?
No.
Well, you should go instead of wasting your time with me. It's only about 75 miles from here. Did you ever hear how Crockfield started?
No, I haven't.
Well, sit down, Jefferson, sit down. It's one of the most touching and endearing stories of our generation. It begins one misty St. Valentine's Eve. The year was 1940. Mary Martin had not yet caused every young heart to flutter as she tripped across the stage as Peter Pan, proving once again that Saratan could keep you from looking 60 years old. The Beatles had not yet written the first note of a rock and roll rigadoon that was to set the nation's hips a-twitching. And Elias P. Crockfield was just emerging from the state penitentiary. Destitute, embittered, cruel of heart, he wandered on this St. Valentine's Eve into a humble church. But there was no godliness in his heart that night, no prayer upon his lips. In the faltering twilight, Elias P. Crockfield made his way towards the poor box. With callous fingers, he ripped open this poignant testimony to a simple people's faith. Greedily, he clutched at the few pitiful coins within. And then a child's wavering treble broke the twilight stillness.
"Please, Mr. Man,"
cried a young girl's voice.
won't you be mine, Valentine?
Elias P. Crockfield turned, and there stood before him a bewitching creature of five, her yellow curls cascading over her shoulders like a golden Niagara. And in her tiny outstretched hand, it was a humble Valentine. In that one crystal moment, a sealed door was ripped open in the heart of Elias P. Crockfield. And in his mind, there was born an idea. 25 years later, 3,000 ruddy-cheeked convicts were gambling along the broad lawns of Crockfield Hall, frolicking in the cool depths of its swimming pool, broadcasting with their own symphony orchestra from their own radio station. Elias P. Crockfield has long since gone to his maker. But the little girl of the golden curls, now grown into lovely young womanhood, is known as the Angel of Crockfield, for she is the wife of the warden. And in the main hallway of Crockfield home, between a Rembrandt and an El Greco, there hangs in a simple frame a humble Valentine.
And in the men's washroom, every Christmas Eve, the ghost of Elias P. Crockfield appears in one of the booths. Will you sign these, please?